Then he heard another male voice. This one was in the room with him. "Who the hell are you?" A man stood in the doorway of Stein's office, with a gun lodged tightly in his fist, pointed across the room. Frost put his hands in the air slowly and carefully. He studied the man's face and recognized him. It was Dr. Stein's husband.
"Take it easy and put the gun down," Frost said. "I'm with the police. You're Jason, aren't you? Let me see your badge."
Frost peeled back the flap of his coat with his fingertips and removed his badge with his other hand. He held it up so Jason could see.
"I've been in contact with your wife about the Nightbird case. My name is Frost Easton. What are you doing here?"
Frost could have lied. He could have used the same story he gave to the guard, but he didn't bother covering up his intentions.
"Your wife is hiding something from me. I need to know what it is. You don't have a warrant. I could have you fired."
"Yes, you probably could. But a young woman is missing, and her life is at stake. She's connected to your wife, just like three other women who are dead now. I think Dr. Stein knows something that could help me find this woman. If you know what's going on, you need to tell me." Jason's grip on the gun loosened. He dropped it into a pocket. "I only know what Frankie shares with me, which isn't much."
"What did she tell you?"
Jason came and stood in front of Frankie's desk. "A former patient tracked her down this week. He said he was having fugues, losing time, and waking up with memories that didn't make any sense. He had visions of being in a white room where he saw women being tortured. They were the women who died, Frankie's patients."
"White room. Where? Something not right."
"What's this man's name?" Frost asked. Jason shook his head. "She won't tell me. It's privileged. This guy is convinced that he's the Nightbird, but Frankie now thinks it's possible that he's being set up by someone else, primed to take the fall for what's happening to these women."
"TF, fall guy. Why does she think that?"
"Because of this," Jason said. Frankie's husband went to a flat-screen television on the rear wall of the office. He found a remote control and switched on the screen. He changed the input to the television's USB port and launched a video. And then he froze the screen on a shot inside a crowded men's room.
"Do you recognize this man?" Jason asked.
Frost stood next to Jason and studied the face.
"That's Darren Newman. What does he have to do with this? Frankie's patient took this video. He was paranoid about what was happening to him, so he started recording the people he met. Frankie found Newman in this video. She didn't think it was a coincidence, and neither do I. Newman's involved."
"This address she wrote down, near the piers. Is it Newman's?"
"His office," Jason said.
"Where is she? Have you heard from her?"
"Yes, she talked to him this evening," Jason said. "She says he's planning something tonight. She's going to follow him and see where he goes."
33. Darren Newman finally left the warehouse after dark. Two blocks away, Frankie spotted the lights of the candy-red Lexus as it backed into the empty street. The car shot toward her, and she ducked down into the passenger seat as its headlights swept across her windshield. When he was gone, she turned on her engine, did a U-turn, and followed him away from the pier. He made a right turn, heading north. She struggled to keep a fix on his taillights and traffic. He drove for several blocks and then pulled into a Shell station. She parked across the street near an auto parts store and watched him from her window. The Muni tracks divided the street between them. When he was done filling his gas tank, Darren wandered over to a beat-up Malibu parked on the cross street. The passenger window slid down and Darren leaned inside. Frankie couldn't see who was in the car, but Darren grabbed his wallet from a back pocket and peeled off several bills. He passed them to someone in the car and received a package in his palm that he quickly secreted in his pocket. He eyed the street and returned to his Lexus.
Drugs.
Frankie wondered what he'd purchased. Marijuana? Pills? Cocaine? Heroin? Or something that could be injected into a woman in a white room? She pulled behind him as Darren left the gas station. Several blocks later, without a signal, he turned toward the water again. As she followed, she noticed a bar across the street named the Dog Patch Saloon. This was the downscale industrial neighborhood
that was quickly being reborn as a hip arts community with yuppie condos. It was also the neighborhood where Todd Ferris had twice awakened on the streets after his lost time. Darren headed for the bay, past a deserted construction site. Weeds grew out of the cracked street. Just ahead, the road narrowed and veered sharply to the right beside a 10-foot concrete retaining wall. She switched off her headlights, and her wheels rolled forward slowly. Where the street ended, the land near the bay opened up around her. A ruined factory loomed to her left. She saw broken windows punched out like missing teeth and metal walls dripping with rust. Directly ahead, she saw a field of boxy self-storage units protected by a tall fence. The gate leading through the fence was open. There were no other vehicles around. Darren had to be inside. Frankie parked near the old factory. She got out, and cold bay air wormed inside her clothes. Wind rattled the factory's metal walls and whistled through the broken windows. She shoved her hands in her pockets and marched quickly through the open gate. The storage units inside were green and no larger than trailers, dropped down in long rows. Wisps of fog swirled around her. The wind felt as if someone was breathing on her neck. Listening, she heard a bang of metal not far away as a garage door opened and closed. When she hurried to the corner, she spotted Darren's Lexus backed up against a storage unit. A crack of light glowed from under the door. She crept closer, feeling exposed. She waited for him in the cold, but time went by slowly, and she heard no noise from inside. Her fingers grew numb, and her cheeks felt raw. When she checked her watch, 15 minutes had passed, and she wondered how much longer he planned to stay. Then, without warning, the garage door slid up from the ground. Not all the way, just a few feet. From inside, Darren's shadow moved like a monster. The lights went off, and she saw Darren squeeze under the open door and lock it behind him. Frankie dove into the recessed doorway of another storage unit. Darren climbed into his car and headed toward her, throwing light across the wall inches from where Frankie hid. He passed her, driving fast. She ran to follow him, but his car was already gone by the time she reached the open gate. Behind her, she heard a guard shout from the doorway of a small security shack, but she didn't stop running. When she got to her car, she backed up into an out-of-control 3-point turn. The guard outside the gate sprinted toward her, but she swerved around him, her lights off. She swung into the narrow street, but didn't turn fast enough, and the stone wall ripped off her side mirror and gouged her door with a sickening scrape. She accelerated, taking the curve in the dark, and switching her lights on. She braked hard, turned the wheel again, and found herself back on the street. 2 blocks ahead of her, she spotted taillights. A light turned red, but she sped through it. Darren's car turned left on 3rd Street, heading south, backtracking on his original route. He was in no hurry now, making it easy to stay in his wake. At the gas station, he turned right, and then merged onto the northbound 280 freeway. At this time of night, traffic moved freely. She matched his speed and stayed behind him. He drove 2 miles and exited at 6th, heading back into the city streets. When he turned again at Bryant, she guessed where he was going. A block later, he took the elevated highway that led toward the Bay Bridge. He was heading across the water. They soon left the city behind as the bridge climbed over the bay. Darren stayed in the left lane. The eastbound lanes were claustrophobic on the lower level of the double-decker span, but when they passed Yerba Buena Island, they emerged into the open air under the white lights of the new bridge tower. She slowed, her eyes drawn to the westbound lanes, where Bryn Lansing had taken a fatal dive to the water. Then she hit her brakes hard because Darren had slowed, too, in the same spot, as if he were remembering. She followed him to the end of the bridge. A mile later, he headed north on Highway 24. The Lexus climbed into the Berkeley Hills and then disappeared into the mouth of the Caldecott Tunnel, heading toward the towns of the East Bay. Beyond the tunnel, he exited immediately, and she almost missed the turn. Then he curled up the twisting mountain road with Frankie behind him. Fog sank down the steep hillside through the trees. His taillights came and went. She was conscious of breathtaking drops falling away into darkness on the right shoulder, where she could see the faraway city lights in the valley. Houses clung precariously to the sharp slope. There had been a fire in this neighborhood years before, burning through the dry grass and reducing dozens of houses to ash, because the roads were too narrow and steep for fire trucks to traverse. Darren pulled ahead of her, driving confidently, as if he'd navigated this route many times. She didn't dare go any faster herself. When she inched around a hairpin turn, she saw that his lights had vanished, and they didn't reappear. She was on the downslope of the mountain now, on a road barely wider than her car. Houses loomed among soaring pine trees on both sides. If he'd come this far, she assumed that he'd turned into one of the steep driveways, but she didn't know which one. Frankie drifted to a stop. She spotted a house with no lights and a foreclosure sign posted outside. She pulled off the road in front of the house and turned off her car. Getting out, she waited in the darkness as a large SUV crept down the narrow road past her. When it was gone, she marched uphill in the middle of the street. The air was cold and damp. Most of the expensive houses were hidden behind walls of trees and vines. She stopped to examine each house, looking for Darren's Lexus. Her presence alerted a dog that barked madly from behind a gate. She passed a car parked on a bed of pine needles, across from a Mediterranean-style home on the other side of the street. It was a blue Nissan, and the hood was warm to the touch. She couldn't see the interior, but she spotted a security decal on the Nissan's windshield from the San Francisco pier near Darren's office. That couldn't be a coincidence. She crossed to the house, which had a sharp driveway curving upward to her left. The garage wasn't visible from the street. She climbed the driveway, her heels slipping on wet leaves. Beyond a hedge wall, she spotted a brightly lit ranch home, built on the precipice of the canyon. Its garage was in front of her, and the door was open. Darren's Lexus was parked inside. The courtyard of the house was protected by a low wrought iron fence. Stone steps led up to a patio, lit by mushroom lights hugging the ground. Wind chimes rang like church bells. A fig tree hung over the path, and terraced hyacinths climbed the slope. She didn't see a lock on the gate. Frankie undid the latch and let herself inside, wincing at the groan of the metal hinges. She left it open behind her. She climbed the wet steps carefully, and when she reached the top, she found herself in a brick courtyard, bordered by flowered vines draped over a wooden trellis. A stone table was placed in the middle of the arbor for entertaining, and she saw a half-full wine glass that had been left behind. On the far side of the courtyard, the warm lights of a bay window glowed against the darkness of the cliff. The house's walls were peach stucco, and a massive double front door guarded the entrance, with narrow stained glass windows on both sides. She crossed the courtyard and took note of the wine glass, which had lipstick on the rim. The interior of the living room was visible. She saw Native American pottery, frontier oil paintings, hand-blown glass art. The walls were painted in vibrant color, and the carpet was a garish pink. She didn't see anyone moving inside. And then she heard it, loudly, surrounding her in the courtyard from hidden speakers, as if she'd triggered it herself. Music. Her heart froze in her chest. She recognized the singer and the song. Carole King's mellow voice lilted from the trellises, crooning about the night bird making its way home. It was the song that had driven three women, three people who had trusted Frankie with their deepest fears, to madness. Nightingale. She had to get inside the house. Frankie started to run forward, but as she did, a hand slapped over her mouth from behind, and she felt her entire body being dragged backward. 34. "Don't say a word," Frost whispered in Dr. Stein's ear. He peeled his hand away from her mouth and turned her around so she could see him. Despite his warning, she opened her mouth to talk, and he put a finger to her lips. He glanced at the house, then grabbed her elbow and dragged her down the stone steps. He walked her all the way back to the street. "How did you find me?" she asked, confronting him with her hands on her hips. "You followed him, I followed you."
I picked you up when you ran the red light in your dog patch. What the hell do you think you're doing, Dr. Stein?
You heard the song. The Nightbird is inside that house.
Darren Newman? Frost said. He saw her flinch with surprise.
Yes, I know about Newman. I talked to your husband.
If you suspected someone, you should have called me, not gone after him yourself.
Don't you think I wanted to call you? That's not how doctor-patient privilege works.
Well, now you've tipped Newman off, and you could have gotten yourself killed in the process. The best thing you can do right now is get out of here. Go home.
I'm sorry, but you need me. If he has a woman in there, if he's using my methods to torture her, then I need to be there to help.
Frost had no time to argue with her, or to wait for the Berkeley police to knock politely on Newman's front door. He could hear the song playing in the garden above him. If a woman really was being tortured in the house, he knew who that woman was. Lucy.
Wait for me in your car, he snapped. Don't get out until I come back.
He turned to the driveway, but Dr. Stein held his arm. Inspector, listen to me. I'm not wrong about this. That button you showed me? I saw Darren's sport coat. It's missing a button just like that one.
I said go back to your car, Dr. Stein.
He watched her walk away unhappily, with her head down and her hands in her pockets. When she disappeared, he jogged up the slick driveway to the patio gate and let himself inside. He climbed the steps, listening to the music, which came from everywhere, in multiple speakers hidden inside the arbor. The song ended and then repeated from the beginning. The Nightbird kept singing, taunting him. A flagstone walkway led from the courtyard to the house. At the living room window, he peered inside. He could see all the way to the open back windows, overlooking the canyon. A pass-through connected the room to the kitchen, which was dark. He could see a hallway leading to the bedrooms, but he didn't see anyone inside. Then, through the speakers, a woman screamed. It sounded as if she were next to him, behind him, above him. Her odd, strangled cry got louder until it drowned out the music, and then, with a gasp, it fell silent. He didn't recognize the distorted voice. He didn't know if it was Lucy. Frost drew his gun. He bolted to the double front doors and pounded on them with his fist. Police! Open the door! No one answered. He twisted the knob with his hand and it turned. The door was open. He shoved it with his shoulder and spilled inside. Cool, cliff-top air whipped through the house from the rear windows. Fresh orchids scented the foyer. Down the dark hallway, a dog barked wildly at the unexpected intruder, scratching to claw its way through a closed door. He shouted again, Police! Carol King stopped singing. A door at the end of the hallway opened, letting out a triangle of light. Frost aimed his gun at the doorway and balanced his wrist with his other hand. Come out slowly and put your hands in the air. He saw a bare foot nudge the door wider. A man stood in the doorway, his hands up, his body lost in shadows. He wore only loose-fitting boxers.
Come closer, Frost demanded. Slowly.
The man approached him, step by step. The light of the foyer splashed over his face, and Frost recognized Darren Newman. Newman's mouth was creased into a smile. He didn't show fear or surprise at a confrontation with an armed policeman inside his house. The dog kept barking from the other bedroom, but Newman silenced it with a snap of his fingers.
"Is there a problem?" Newman asked.
Frost didn't lower his gun.
Who else is in this house?
My secretary.
I heard a woman scream, Frost said. What can I say? Simona is loud when we're having sex. Get her out here, Frost snapped.
Newman rolled his eyes and called over his shoulder. Simona, there's someone who wants to meet you. The cops want to make sure I'm not strangling you or something. Frost kept an eye on the doorway. The bedroom door opened all the way, revealing the rumpled end of a king-sized bed, and walls covered in a metallic wallpaper made up of different stripes of blue. A young woman wandered toward him, unconcerned by his gun. She had severely short blonde hair, and she wore a peach-colored man's dress shirt, unbuttoned on the front to reveal her stomach and the half-moons of her breasts. A black towel was wrapped around her waist.
"Is this one of your jokes, Darren?" she asked. "Is this guy a stripper or something?"
"No, he's really a cop."
Frost reholstered his gun. "Are you all right, miss?"
"Other than being interrupted in the middle of a good banging, I'm fine," she told him. Are you here voluntarily? Were you coerced in any way to have sex this evening?
Coerced? Hardly.
Have you taken any drugs or consumed any alcohol?
That's none of your business, Simona fired back. And if you're planning to tell me about Darren's past, don't be boring. I know all about it. You people should leave him alone.
Do you remember how you got here tonight? Frost asked.
Do I remember? The woman asked. What kind of question is that?
Newman flicked his fingers like a magician, readying an illusion. He thinks I put you in a trance to have sex with me. You're hypnotized. Didn't you realize? Haven't you seen the news today? When I play the song Nightingale, you will get on your back, and you won't remember a thing in the morning.
Oh, I'll remember, Simona told Frost. Believe me, I'm all stretched out.
Newman winked. Well, are you satisfied, officer?
For now, Frost replied. Then get out of the house. Leave me your card, too.
I bet your superiors will be interested to hear about you breaking in here with your gun in hand. Of course, I was really hoping it would be Frankie. I was looking forward to taking out a restraining order against her.
Frost began to appreciate Newman's talent for manipulation. He could see in the man's reptilian eyes exactly what he was, a ruthless, calculating predator.
You knew Dr. Stein was following you?
Sure. I spotted her behind me on the bridge. She's scary. You should keep an eye on her. No telling what she might do.
Darren's right, Simona added. I met the bitch. You could tell she was hot for him. I think she's obsessed.
Newman gave the woman's bare ass a playful slap.
Go back to bed, love. I'll be there in a minute.
Simona walked down the hallway with an exaggerated sway in her hips. Frost was careful to keep his eyes on Newman's face, and not on the barely dressed girl. Newman grabbed a pack of cigarettes from a bowl near the open front door and strolled with Frost out to the courtyard. He lit a cigarette and blew smoke into the cold air.
Is this your house? Frost asked him.
My parents own it. They're in Zurich now. They travel a lot.
Your parents have been very good to you. They get you out of a lot of trouble.
That's what parents do, Newman replied.
What about the dog? Does he belong to them, too?
No, that's Simona's. Pissant yipper dog never shuts up. I may have to kill him.
He made the threat so casually that it took Frost's breath away. There was not a shred of doubt in his mind that Newman was serious. It made him want to go back inside and tell the young girl that she was in danger, even if she didn't believe him.
A lot of people think you killed Marilyn Summers, too, Frost told him.
Sooner or later, every bitch needs to be put down,
Newman said with a smirk.
None of this is funny.
No? You're just like Frankie. You don't appreciate my sense of humor.
Frost leaned in close to the man, but Darren Newman didn't look easily intimidated. He was too cocky, too sure of himself.
Where is she? Frost asked.
Who?
Lucy Hagen.
I have no idea who that is, Newman replied. I want her back. I want her back right now.
Is this another one of Frankie's unfortunate patients? Too bad. I wonder what this one will do when the music starts playing. Drive her car off a cliff? Swallow a bottle of pills? Slit her wrists? Whoever this nightbird is, you have to admire his imagination.
Frost didn't like being baited, and this man was good at it.
You made a mistake this time, Mr. Newman. You screwed up. Did I? How so?
He took another casual drag on his cigarette.
You've been setting someone up. A man you wanted to frame, just like you framed Leon Willis. The thing is, this man caught you on videotape in a bar. We can put the two of you together. That's going to make it hard to sell him as the one behind the game. It won't be like Marilyn Summers.
In the semi-darkness of the courtyard, Frost saw a darker shadow flit across Darren Newman's face. He'd struck a nerve. Newman didn't know about the video. Even so, the man's smile quickly returned.
I have no idea what you're talking about, he replied. But a video of me in a bar? Is that the best you can do? I go to a lot of bars. I'm a party animal. Simona will tell you that.
I think you better take a long, hard look at the lies that Frankie has been spreading about me. I'm beginning to wonder whether Frankie is doing this herself. The woman isn't stable. She lost her father recently, did you know that? Tragedies like that can push people over the edge.
Frost turned away, but Newman called after him.
Don't forget to leave me your card.
Frost dug in his wallet and extracted a card, which he placed in Newman's hand. The man studied it in the dim light of the garden. "Inspector Frost Easton," he said. "Who's your boss in the department, Frost?"
"Jess Sauceda."
"Oh, sure, I know Jess. I'm sure she remembers me, too. I'll call her tomorrow and tell her about your visit this evening. I think she'll tell you and Frankie to stay away from me. The last thing the San Francisco police need is another harassment lawsuit."
The light inside the car cast shadows under Francesca Stein's eyes. She brushed back a few loose strands of her brown hair and faked a smile, but Frost could see that she was broken down. Her face, which was always thin, looked fragile. She had her hands in her lap. Her back was arrow straight. Hot air blew from the vents, making the interior warm.
"He knew I was following him," she said.
"Yes."
"He played me. He lured me here, and he knew I'd make a fool of myself. No one will believe a thing I say about him now."
"For what it's worth, I think you're right about him," Frost told her. "But my own credibility isn't going to be too high after tonight either."
Stein turned to face him. Something about her vulnerability made him conscious of how attractive she was.
"I'm sorry that I put you in that position," she said.
"Newman's good at what he does," Frost said.
"Yes, he is."
She leaned back against the headrest. He could see the slope of her neck.
"Can I confess something to you, Frost? I'm not sure why. I just feel the need to say it out loud."
He noticed that she'd used his first name, which she'd never done before.
"Say whatever you like."
"I was attracted to Darren Newman when I met him," she said. "I hate it. I'm not proud of it, but it was chemical. I'm sure that makes no sense to you."
"I'm a man. I'm never on safe ground trying to figure out what women want."
"Well, you'd think I'd be smarter than that, but I'm not. I'm married. I'm older than he is. I'm a scientist. I still found him difficult to resist."
"Did you sleep with him?"
She hesitated long enough to make him wonder what she was going to say.
"No."
"Then it sounds like you have nothing to regret," he replied. But he wondered if she was lying.
"Oh, I have plenty of regrets when it comes to Darren," Stein said.
The shadows made her face difficult to read. He wished that he understood her better, but this woman lived in a separate world where he couldn't reach her.
"You're wrong about something, you know."
"What's that?"
"You said I didn't like you."
"I do.
I didn't think I would, but that's just because I don't have a great history with therapists.
You're smart, tough, and you care about your patients. I respect that."
"Thank you."
"I also need your help," he said. "Another woman disappeared yesterday. We both know the danger she's in. I need to find her. Every minute counts."
Stein closed her eyes.
"One of my patients?"
"She came to your office this week. Her name is Lucy Hagen."
"What do you want? What can I do?"
"Tell me about TF, Frost said.
He could feel her freeze.
"What?"
"You wrote a note. TF, fall guy."
"How do you know about that?" she asked.
"I was in your office. I found the note in your garbage can."
"You searched my office?" Stein asked. "I can't believe you did that."
"You didn't give me any choice."
"Did you look at my patient files?"
"No, I didn't violate anyone's privacy."
"Except mine."
She shook her head in dismay. "I don't care if you're angry. The only thing I care about is stopping this man before he hurts anyone else, and you're standing in my way. I'm not the enemy, Frankie. You've got to tell me the truth. You have a patient with the initials TF, and he knows something about the Nightbird. I need to talk to him."
"I'm sorry. He's adamant. No police. I can't give him up just because you want me to. That's not how it works."
"Then talk to him," Frost said. "Persuade him."
"I'll try, but I can't promise you anything."
"I need whatever he can tell me."
Frost opened the door of the car, letting in cool air and the noise of the wind in the pines. He hesitated.
"Darren told me you lost your father recently. Is that true?"
"Yes, it is."
"I'm sorry."
She didn't seem to care about gestures of sympathy.
"What did Darren say about it?"
"It's not important."
"I want to know. Please."
"He said tragedies like that can push someone over the edge," Frost said.
Stein reached out and took hold of the steering wheel with clenched fists.
"That bastard,"
Does that mean something to you?
My father went over the edge of a cliff in Point Reyes while he was hiking, Stein said.
I'm sorry, he said again. I haven't lost a parent, but I can imagine how difficult it must be.
It was a complicated relationship, Stein said. We weren't close.
Even so.
Stein stared through the windshield. Driving here, over the hills, I kept looking over the edge of the cliff. I thought about what it must be like to fall, how your body accelerates, how the ground rushes toward you. What do you have time to think about? What goes through your head? I wonder about his last moments.
You shouldn't do this to yourself, Frost said. But he wasn't sure that she was even aware that he was still in the car with her.
I keep feeling like I'm missing something, she began. Her voice trailed away. Her mouth was open. He thought, what's your worst memory?
Frankie.
A tremble shuddered in her lower lip. A single glassy tear slipped down her face like melting snow. Her brown eyes were fixed in the darkness. Then, out of nowhere, her entire body convulsed. A spasm jolted her like the touch of a live wire, and she grabbed hold of herself and caved inward.
Frankie!
Her body twitched violently. Her knees slammed up against the steering wheel. He grabbed one flying wrist, then the other. He held her as she wriggled in his grasp, and she screamed out one word, drawing it out long and loud.
Stop!
Seconds later, as quickly as it had come, the seizure washed away. Her body calmed. Her breathing quieted, and her face reddened with embarrassment.
I'm so sorry, she murmured.
Are you okay? What was that?
Grief, she said. A panic attack. That's all. Everything in the world caught up with me for a moment.
Come to my car. I'll drive you to the hospital. She shook her head.
I'm fine now.
You shouldn't drive.
She put a hand on top of his. Her skin was moist.
It would help if you could not be a cop for a minute, Frost.
I'm not being a cop, just a human being.
Then trust me when I tell you I'll be fine. It came, it went, it's not coming back.
Do you have some kind of illness? Is it epilepsy?
No, there's nothing like that, really. You don't have to worry about me. I'm a big girl. I don't need anyone to rescue me.
I'll follow you back to the city, Frost said. I want to make sure you don't have any problems.
If you like.
Reluctantly, Frost got out of the car. He hiked down the narrow street toward his Suburban, but he kept looking back over his shoulder. Dr. Stein started the engine of her own car, but she waited for him instead of driving away. He climbed into his SUV and put the truck into drive, and both of their vehicles headed back into the Berkeley Hills. He thought about Francesca Stein as he followed her. She was strange, complicated, and beautiful, like a puzzle box for which there was no key. He liked her, but he didn't particularly like the way she made him feel. She was out of his league.
35. Frankie parked in the underground garage of her building in the Tenderloin. It was late, and she was alone. She walked to the elevator with her head down and her hands tightly gripping her elbows, as if she could hold herself up that way. When she got home, her condominium was dark. She uncorked an open bottle of wine in the refrigerator and poured herself a glass, which she carried up the stairs to their bedroom. Jason was asleep. She stood at the end of the bed and drank her wine and stared at her husband. When the wine was gone, which didn't take long, she cupped the glass in her palm. Eventually, as he shifted, he became aware of her presence. He pushed himself up in bed.
Frankie?
Yes.
Silence lingered between them.
Are you coming to bed?
He asked. She didn't answer, and he leaned over to turn on the lamp on its nightstand. A yellow glow illuminated them.
What's wrong?
He asked. Frankie turned away and went to the windows. She put the toe of her heels against the wall and rested her forehead and palms on the glass. It was like flying. The long fall to the street stretched out below her.
"Something happened to me tonight," she said.
Jason got out of bed. "What is it? Was it Newman? Did he do something to you?"
"No, it's not that," she said.
"Then what?"
"I had what I'm pretty sure was a psychogenic seizure."
Jason folded his arms on his chest. He looked clinical. "How bad?"
"Bad enough. Muscle spasms, panic, sweating."
"Has this ever happened to you before? Have there been previous episodes?"
"No, this was the first." He sat back down on the bed.
"We should have you tested to make sure there wasn't a physical cause."
"That's not necessary," Frankie replied. "I know what this was."
They stared at each other.
She could see the truth in his face. He knew where this conversation was going.
She should have guessed it much earlier, but she'd written off the mental clues to stress and grief. Doctors made the worst patients. She turned around and leaned back against the window. Part of her hoped it would give way and let her fall.
"We both know what caused this, don't we?" she asked him.
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"Do you remember the patient I told you about 3 years ago?" Frankie asked. "He was involved in an attempted mugging in Los Angeles. He had a concealed handgun, which he used to shoot the assailant. Then he tried to give CPR, but the mugger died of the gunshot wound. The man was tormented by what he'd done, regardless of the justification. He came to me because he wanted his memory of the event completely erased."
"I remember," Jason said.
2 months after our treatment, he began to have seizures. The doctors thought it was epilepsy, but there were no abnormalities in his EEG. They sent him back to me, and I realized his brain was rebelling against what we'd done. The actual memory of the event was gone, but the underlying trauma was still there. It took a much longer series of traditional treatments to work its way through it."
Jason didn't ask why she was telling him this.
"Heights have never bothered me before," she went on. "But do you know what I see when I look down now?"
"What?"
"I see my father, at the base of the cliff." "That's strange, because I wasn't there. I was at our campsite when he went hiking. I never saw my father's body. I was never on the cliff, and I never looked over the edge. The rangers found him. And yet I can see it in my head, Jason. I can see him lying there."
"What do you want me to say?" her husband asked.
"I want you to admit what you did to me. You changed my memory of that weekend, didn't you? All along I thought that I'd blocked it out. All I could see were images, snapshots. But they were images you planted there, right? You erased what really happened. You erased what I saw."
Jason stood in front of her, his face a mask. "Yes, I did."
"Why?"
"Because you asked me to," he said.
Frankie closed her eyes. He wasn't lying. She'd already realized what the truth had to be. This was something she'd chosen. "Was any of it real?" she asked.
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean. Did he really say he was proud of me?"
Jason didn't answer immediately. Then he said, "Why go down this road, Frankie? There's a reason you wanted to forget it."
"I want to know," she snapped. "Tell me."
"No, your father never said that."
"You lied to me. You planted a lie in my head."
"A lie? Get over yourself. It's no different than what you do with patients every day. You take away bad memories and you replace them with better memories. Don't blame me if you don't like your own medicine."
He was right about that, too. She looked into a mirror, and she didn't like what she saw. What Jason had done to her was exactly what she did to her own patients. She left her fingerprints inside their brains. She played God. Now, for the first time, she knew what it felt like to be on the receiving end. She wondered how many of the people she'd tried to help found themselves riddled with doubts after it was over. How many of them felt as if they were staring into a well where they couldn't see the bottom? How many wished they could know the truth again, after the truth had been swept away? "What really happened out there?" she asked quietly.
He shook his head. "It's wrong for me to tell you. You didn't want to remember."
"Look, if you don't tell me, I'll just go downstairs and ask Pam. She knows what you did, right?"
"Yes."
"So tell me," Frankie said.
"What do you remember?" Jason asked.
"Nothing. I remember nothing. Just the image of him where he fell, how his body looked, his blood on the rocks." She stopped because the image began to get clearer in her brain. The blood was a new detail. She hadn't seen it before in her flashbacks.
"If I tell you, it might make it worse," he pointed out. "Sometimes the memories come back more intensely and more painful than before."
"I'll take that risk. Right now I have to know."
Jason laced his fingers on top of his head, and he grimaced, as if he were on a jury, deciding someone's guilt or innocence.
"Your father didn't fall. He jumped."
Frankie's knees quivered. She felt dizzy, and she pitched forward, and Jason caught her. He helped her to the bed, and then he went to the bathroom and prepared a warm, damp towel, which he dabbed against her face. He sat down next to her, their legs touching.
"I saw it?" she asked.
"You went hiking with him that morning, the way you usually did. He was ahead of you on the cliff trail. You saw what he was about to do, and you shouted for him to stop, but he simply fell. And then he ran to the edge and saw him on the beach below. You couldn't deal with it. You went back to the campsite. You stayed in your tent for hours, and then finally, you went to find the rangers, and you told them your father was missing." She shook her head in disbelief.
"For God's sake, why did he do it? Did I say something? Did we argue?
You know he had bouts of depression. He'd talked about suicide before."
"Yes, but he was the supreme narcissist. It was just talk. I can't believe he actually did it."
"Sometimes people act in a split second," Jason said. "One moment he's on the cliff, and an impulse takes him, and he's in the air. At that point, it's too late to go back and stop." Frankie closed her eyes. She tried to summon tears, but she couldn't.
"Do you remember it now?" Jason asked finally.
She stared into her brain and tried to draw a picture of that last morning. Even knowing what had happened, she saw nothing, and thinking harder didn't change anything. She dipped a brush into paint, but with each stroke she applied, the canvas stayed blank. Everything Jason had told her was no more real to her than a story that had happened to someone else. It made her think of the theme her father had chosen for their discussions that last weekend. Risk. She'd taken a risk, just like the patients who came to her took a risk. You can take away your pain, but once it's done, it's done. You're in the air. It's too late to go back and stop. Their memories, those little proteins that made up life, were gone.
"No," she said. "I don't remember anything at all."
Frost awoke to music. He shifted on the sofa, which disturbed Shaq, who hopped down to the carpet. Disoriented, he realized that the music was a Jefferson Airplane song, White Rabbit. He lay on his back, listening to Grace Slick's angry, erotic voice, before he realized that the music was coming from his phone. He'd chosen White Rabbit as the ringtone for Herb, who'd partied with a San Francisco group as a 19-year-old in 1967. He'd seen a photo of Herb with Grace Slick and Marty Balin at the Monterey Festival that June. Sometimes his friend told stories from that summer, and Frost realized that, even back then, Herb was at the center of everything that went on in the city. Frost rolled off the sofa and stumbled to the dining room table, where he'd left his phone.
"Herb, what time is it?"
"Almost 2. I'm sorry to wake you up."
"Don't worry about it. What's going on?"
"Street Twitter came through."
Frost was instantly awake.
"What did you find out? Did someone see Lucy?"
"No,
but a guy wearing that creepy mask gave $20 to a homeless vet to pass along a message."
"What message?" Frost asked. His friend hesitated, didn't answer.
"Herb, come on. What was the message?" It may be nothing. This guy may just be playing games with you.
Tell me.
He said if you want to find what you're looking for, ask Katie.
Frost's fist clenched. He breathed in and out.
I have to go, he told Herb. Listen to me. He's just getting inside your head. That's what he's trying to do.
I have to go, Frost repeated. Thanks, Herb. Really.
He hung up the phone, and he stood in the nighttime chill of the house. If the nightbird wanted to get inside Frost's head, he'd succeeded. Frost knew exactly where to look for Lucy. She was in the back seat of a car near Ocean Beach. That was where he'd found his sister's body.
36.
Near Ocean Beach, the thunder of the waves was unrelenting. Frost got out of his SUV and felt salty spray on his face. The long stretch of the Great Highway down the hill from Cliff House was deserted, but Frost could feel the night bird watching him. Somewhere in the darkness of the beach, or on the rocky trails of Sutro Heights above him, the man had binoculars to spy on his prey. The stretch of sand here was wide, flat, and seemingly endless, like a cold imitation of Santa Monica. He shivered as the damp chill got inside his bones. Across the street, he spotted one lonely car in the beachfront parking lot. It was an Imperial Blue Chevy Malibu. This was no accident. The nightbird had done his research. Katie had driven the same kind of car. He ran the vehicle plate. The car had been stolen 3 days ago. It was all part of the plan. Frost called for backup, but he didn't wait for the sirens. He had to know. Ocean wind screeched in his ears and a headache pounded behind his eyes. He crossed the street toward the Malibu just like he'd done once before, when a mysterious phone call took him here, in the middle of the night, 6 years ago.
Are you looking for Katie?
Yes, I am.
How did you...
She said she's waiting for you at Ocean Beach.
What? Who is this?
A cloud of sand rose off the beach and blew grit into his face. White surf undulated from the water. His chest felt heavy. Time drew out, making each step a journey against an invisible tide. He didn't want to get there. He didn't want to see what was waiting for him. Streaks of mud crusted over the car's blue paint. He saw a single sentence scrawled in the dirt of the rear window. The same awful question. What's your worst memory? Frost remembered everything about that night. Every sensation was tattooed on his brain. The blue and green wool of the blanket in the back seat covering Katie. The cool metal of the door handle. Her torso spilling out, head nearly severed, blood everywhere, like a red ocean. The wail of his own screams. He pulled open the rear door of the Malibu, and his heart seized. Again, again, again! A blanket covered Lucy's body, blue and green wool, in the same diamond design. He knelt down, using both hands to peel back the blanket to reveal her face. And there she was, eyes closed, perfect and peaceful. He put two fingers on the soft skin of her neck, and he found a heartbeat. She was alive. Frost yanked the blanket from her body. She wore the same outfit as when he'd last seen her, cropped jeans, striped top. Gently, he lifted her torso and climbed into the back of the car beside her. He rustled her shoulders and whispered her name.
Lucy, it's Frost. Lucy, wake up.
Her eyes blinked open and closed, and open again. She tried to focus, but her gaze wandered, as if she were following the buzz of a fly. Her limbs squirmed. A groan rumbled from her throat.
Lucy, it's me.
She shook off the fog. Her fingers rubbed her face and left pink impressions on her skin. Through dry lips, she said,
Frost?
Yeah.
I don't... Where are we?
Long story. Do you remember anything? What's the last thing you remember? Her eyes blinked again.
I don't even know.
That's okay. Hang on. I'm getting you out of here.
Frost climbed out of the car and listened for the wail of an ambulance, but he heard nothing. He leaned in again and put his arms under Lucy's knees and around her back. Instinctively, she clung to his neck and let him carry her out of the car. He kicked the door shut with his foot and half ran across the great highway back to his Suburban. Part of him wanted to scream at the Nightbird, knowing the man was watching him. "Why are you doing this?" At his truck, he eased Lucy into the front seat, just as he'd done once before, atop the Bay Bridge. He called in an update and threw his phone on the seat between them. He headed east, driving fast and using his siren to cruise uphill through the stop signs. The nearest hospital was on the other side of Golden Gate Park, 3 miles away. Lucy stared vacantly through the windshield as the city flashed by on both sides. He kept looking at her as he drove, but she didn't look back at him. Pieces of a puzzle worked their way through her brain. Finally, she said, "He took me?" Frost nodded. "Yes." Lucy was silent again as he sped through 2 more intersections, and then she went on.
"How long?"
"More than 24 hours.
"An entire day," she murmured. "I don't remember any of it."
"What do you remember?"
I remember picking out a dress to meet you. I draped it across the bed. After that, nothing."
He glanced at the expression on her face, which was intense, as if thinking hard would bring everything back.
"Where are you taking me?" she asked.
"The hospital. I want you checked out." Frost kept driving through the residential neighborhoods, which were empty of traffic. The up-and-down hills made a roller coaster, and the Suburban nearly left the ground as he shot over each peak. He made good time. He was already turning toward the emergency room on the east end of the park, when Lucy suddenly grabbed his arm and said in an urgent voice, "Frost, stop!" He swung the SUV sharply to the curb opposite the University of San Francisco campus. "What is it? Are you okay?" Lucy unhooked her safety belt and scrambled across the seat. She threw her arms around him and leaned into his neck. He could feel the heat of her skin. Her body shivered and her breathing was crazy fast. "Frost, I'm scared. What did he do to me? What did he put in my head?"
"You tell me. Is there anything? Any memories? Any feelings?"
"No, it's all blank. I need to know what he did. We can't wait. Whatever it is, we need to get it out."
"I can call Dr. Stein and ask her to meet us there. She's the expert." Her reaction was volcanic.
"No, no, not her, not her. I never want to see her again, ever, ever. Don't make me see her again, Frost. Please, I never want to look at her face."
She burrowed closer to him and held him tight, as if she were hanging from a bridge and he could keep her from falling. Her fingernails dug deeply into his flesh.
"You don't have to see her," Frost said. "Don't worry. We'll talk to someone else."
"Take me home," Lucy said. "Not the hospital. Just take me home."
"Your apartment isn't safe."
"Then take me to your place, please."
"I'm sorry, Lucy. The rule is you see a doctor first. We don't know what he did to you. We need to make sure you're okay."
Lucy slid back to her seat with a wild look of despair. Panicked tears rolled down her cheeks. She shook her head over and over, and she wrung her sweaty hands together. Blood smeared her mouth where she'd bitten through her lip. She was disintegrating before his eyes, and he wanted her with a doctor now. He put the Suburban into gear, but as the truck lurched forward, she took him completely by surprise. Without warning, she punched open the passenger door of the SUV. She practically fell into the street as he jammed the brakes, and then she took off at a sprint across the intersection. Frost recovered from his shock and threw open his own door. "Lucy!" He reached for his phone, but he realized that she'd grabbed it from the seat. "Lucy, stop!" She was already 20 yards away, passing under the streetlight and charging up the lone mountain hillside toward the USF campus. The silhouette of the university tower loomed at the summit behind the tall trees. Frost jumped from the Suburban and laid chase. He ran for the slope and climbed after her through wet dirt and grass, but the darkness masked her trail. He followed blindly, shouting her name, "Lucy!" She didn't answer, and he didn't see her. The fir trees dotting the hillside kept her hidden. He stopped to listen for the noise of her footsteps as she moved higher toward the tower, but he didn't hear her. Instead, in the quiet, he heard something else. Music. Sweet, horrifying music. Somewhere close by, among the trees, he heard the gentle notes of a piano solo. He recognized the song. It was a killing song.
"Lucy, don't!" he called.
He ran toward the sound, hearing it get louder, but he was too late to stop the music. The piano solo gave way to Carole King's perfect voice, trilling about the nightbird, about the sailor seeking rest, about the nightingale singing out the theme to a stranger's lonely life. His eyes tried to find Lucy among the trees, and all the while he expected to hear her scream, like the others, scream, run, die. A pinpoint glow shined 30 feet away. It was the white light of a phone screen. His phone. He skidded across the slope from tree to tree and found her with her back against one of the evergreens. In the glow of the phone, her brown eyes were scared. Her hair was messy. He closed the distance between them in a second and gathered her up in his arms, and she buried herself against him. He could feel the pounding up and down swell of her chest. He tried to pull the phone from her hand, but she struggled, and the song kept playing, tinny and loud. It was deep into the second verse before he realized something. Nothing was happening to her. Carole King sang, and the piano played, and Lucy's mind didn't break into little pieces. Not like Monica Farr, or Bryn Lansing, or Christie Park. Lucy realized it, too, and her eyes opened wide with relief. "It didn't work," she murmured. "Right? It didn't work."
"I guess not," he whispered. But he wasn't so sure. He almost wished she'd lost control right here, where he could hold her and keep her safe. Then, at least, he'd know what the nightbird had done to her.
The song drifted to an end and left them in silence. They didn't move. He could feel her holding onto him, and in the darkness of the hillside she was soft and warm. Her body relaxed, as if a storm had passed. She had a faint smell of perfume in his arms. Finally, she let go and stared at him just inches away. Her face was filled with yearning and confusion.
"Do you think I'm really okay?" she asked.
"I hope so. Let's get you to the hospital and make sure."
"Frost, don't let anything happen to me,"
Lucy said, taking his hand. "I won't," he told her. "Don't worry. I won't." 37.
Pam dressed to make sure everyone was looking at her. She wore a knee-length bodycon dress in a bold orange color, with black buttons making an S from her neck to her hips. Her blonde hair framed her face and hung in layers halfway down her back. Her lipstick was baby pink. She wore a tiny, crooked smile, as if the world were a joke, and she knew the punchline. For Frankie, staring at Pam was like looking in a mirror that transformed her into a younger, more erotic version of herself. She felt jealous of Pam, and Pam felt jealous of her. The war never ended. She sat down opposite Pam at the Zingari window table. Virgil, whose dark eyes looked hungover, swooped in with iced tea, and Pam already had a martini in front of her. Her sister pointedly studied her phone without looking up. Frankie ordered a prosciutto pizza for lunch.
"So all this time, you knew,"
Frankie said, after the silence had gone on too long. Her sister didn't stop texting.
"That Daddy took a dive?"
"Yes."
"And it doesn't bother you?"
Pam put down the phone and laced her long fingers together. Her fingernails matched her dress.
"What part do you mean, sis? That part where our father kills himself? Or the part where my delicate flower of a sister can't handle it and decides to forget the whole thing?"
Frankie thought. Missile launched. She wanted to fire back in kind, but she didn't even remember enough to explain herself. She didn't know why she'd felt the need to wipe away what she saw. She'd always thought of herself as strong, but maybe Pam was right. Maybe Frankie was afraid of feeling anything. Love, hate, desire, grief. God knows Pam would never let emotion get in the way of doing what she wanted.
"You've been playing with me, haven't you?" Frankie asked.
"What do you mean?" "The things you've said about Dad lately. It was a game to you. You wanted to see if I remembered anything." Pam sipped her martini and shrugged. "I've always wondered if your shrink biz is just a big scam. Can you really change someone's memory? Or if you poke and prod, does it all come rushing back?"
"It doesn't work like that."
Virgil returned to the table. He put a caprese salad in front of Pam and glanced between the sisters. If you're going to have a girl fight, ladies, at least give me time to sell tickets.
No fight, Pam said with a cool stare at Frankie. She knows I'd win.